All right, well, good morning, everyone. Thank you, Matt, for that reading. We'll return to that account involving King Saul and the Amalekites later on in my thoughts this morning. Now, compared to the other kings of the Old Testament, the reign of King Saul is rather a singular one for a few different reasons, and I wonder if it's because of that singularity that oftentimes the reign of King Saul is overlooked. Oftentimes, we dismiss King Saul's reign as nothing more than a transition in the history of Israel from the judges to the lineage of David, or perhaps we dismiss him as nothing more than a lesson for the children of Israel to learn, a careful what you wish for type of lesson. But I think most commonly we dismiss King Saul as nothing more than a heel to David, someone to allow David to shine and someone to drive his narrative, as it were. And while I do think that King Saul serves those purposes, when we make him only about those things, we really make him only apply towards other people, towards the Jews and towards David. And I think then we really fail to really give any consideration as to what we may learn in our own lives from his reign. And I think that's a tremendous shame for a couple of reasons. For one thing, I don't believe that the Lord planned or considered King Saul's reign to only apply towards those other people. And when we dismiss him outright, it reminds me of how some people dismiss the Old Testament entirely, how some people look at the Old Testament and the Old Law, and they say that Christ came along, did away with that. Therefore, there's no application there. There's no utility. And I think that when we dismiss Saul's reign as, again, nothing more than a transition, a way to get from point A to point B, we do something similar, and we fail to really make any personal application to ourselves. And we obviously know how foolish it is to dismiss the Old Testament entirely because we can learn about God and his will for us. And in the same way, I think that King Saul's reign can teach us a lot on those very subjects. The second reason I think it's a tremendous shame to dismiss King Saul's reign outright is because I find the struggles that King Saul went through, his shortcomings, just to be so relatable to myself, especially when compared to the other kings of the Old Testament. When it comes to many of the wicked kings, I really can't relate to their shortcomings at all. I can't relate to worshiping idols. I can't relate to subverting the people's faith to maintain political power. And I certainly can't relate to the idea of sacrificing my children to some false god. And even some of the good kings, I struggle to relate to their shortcomings. I think of David. I can't relate to his sins. I can't relate to adultery and effectively murder. But I can absolutely relate to feelings of being overwhelmed at being called by the Lord, towards struggling in moments of difficulty to lean on him and trust in his word, towards putting my own seemingly worldly wisdom ahead of his, and really to fail to trust in him and lean on my own abilities. And as we'll talk about this morning, Saul was guilty of all those things. And as such, I find him to be tremendously relatable and someone that I think we can learn a lot from. So today, I would like to spend our time together considering the reign of King Saul, what we can learn about and what we can apply to ourselves. And to accomplish this, I will be looking at four different examples and four different moments in the reign of King Saul that I believe represent four distinct shortcomings of his. We'll look at those and consider if perhaps we may be guilty of those. And I would like to spend a little bit of time on those because time and again, David shows us really what the Lord expects of us. And I mentioned before that I do believe that in many ways, David or King Saul allowed David the opportunity to shine. But for me, I find the most utility and I find a lot to be learned when we compare Saul to David, because in many ways, that's the comparison between our own worldly nature and what God would have of us. And as a bit of a disclaimer, though, I don't intend for this to be an entire character study of King Saul, nor do I intend for this to be an entire study of 1 Samuel. Rather, I believe by focusing on those moments, those particular shortcomings, that we will find the most room for personal examination. And that's not easy. I think oftentimes one of the other reasons we dismiss Saul is when we look at the quote-unquote bad guys in Scripture, I think we don't really see ourselves there. And oftentimes we dismiss that without giving any consideration towards personal application. But I picked this topic specifically because, like I said before, I think the struggles and the shortcomings of Saul are ones that I find myself guilty of. And I think all of us can if we're not careful. Before we really dive in, I do want to provide a bit of context here. I think most of us are familiar with King Saul's reign, but for those of us that aren't, and to provide a bit of a lead up to this, King Saul's reign came on the heels of the period in time of Israel's history known as the Judges. During that time, there was no king, but rather individuals judged Israel and led them. And this period in time is really marked by instability in the nation of Israel and just tremendous struggle. And unfortunately, the people never connected the dots between those periods and struggle and their own sinful ways. And so we really see here just a decline in their culture. I saw that many scholars refer to this as the Dark Ages of Israel's history. And we see at the very tail end of that, that the last of the judges, the prophet Samuel, emerges in the book of 1 Samuel, which also contains the entire history of King Saul's reign. Now, in 1 Samuel chapter 7, we read about how upon the return of the ark, that Samuel encouraged all the people to give up their idols and rededicate themselves to the Lord. And so the people come together, they do so, but this draws the attention of the Philistines who come out to battle them. And after Samuel makes a sacrifice, that they end up having what really for them was a surprise victory over the Philistines, a tremendous victory for them. They're able to reclaim some of their lands, and for them, this was a huge moment. And it says after that that Samuel judged them from that time on. But we read then in chapter 8, after some time has passed, that Samuel has grown old and that his sons are known to be wicked. And this puts the children of Israel in a precarious position, at least in their own minds, because again, having failed to connect their own sinful ways with their struggles as a nation, they viewed their success or failure in the lens of who's leading us. And they were fearful that if they had a wicked judge over them, that they would slide back into that period of struggle, that they would lose these lands. And so they grew afraid of that. And so the children of Israel look around, they look at all the other nations that have abused them over the years, and they see that all of them have kings. Therefore, they decide that they need a king. And they put this demand upon Samuel to do so. And this was a major misstep for the children of Israel, as we all know, and one that the Lord acknowledges in verse 7 of chapter 8. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Heed the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for have they not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them." We then read how the Lord instructs Samuel to warn the people about what the conduct of this king would be. But the people are adamant. We read in verses 19 and 20, and these are important verses to notice. We'll come back to this, where it says, "Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, 'No, but we will have a king over us, that we may also be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles.'" And it's then into this situation that Saul steps forward. And I think that backstory is important because the situation that Israel was in and really what they expected of their king, I think, weighed on Saul repeatedly. And I think that influenced a lot of his decisions. Saul is then introduced in chapter 9 with verse 2 reading, referencing Saul's father, a Benjamite. "And he had a choice and handsome son, whose name was Saul. There was not a more handsome person than he among the children of Israel. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people." We then read how he encounters Samuel in verses 15 through 17. "Now the Lord had told Samuel in his ear the day before Saul came, saying, 'Tomorrow about this time I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him commander over my people Israel, that he may save my people from the hand of the Philistines. For I have looked upon my people, because their cry has come to me.' So when Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said to him, 'There he is, the man of whom I spoke to you. This one shall reign over my people.'" Then we read about how the next day Samuel anoints Saul, but he does so in private, just the two of them. Because it's then later on in chapter 10 that Samuel calls the entirety of the Israel nation together, and he tells them that they'll be picking a king for them. And he tells them to come forward by tribe and clan, and that the tribe of Benjamin's chosen, the family of Matri's chosen, then of course, the new king Saul is chosen. When the people look around, Saul's nowhere to be found, and they search for him, and ultimately, the Lord has to tell them that he's hiding as it's described in the equipment. And this is the first moment that I'd like for us to consider, because I look at this moment, the very, very beginning of his reign, to really be a major misstep. Because consider what we've discussed so far, the situation that Israel was in. The people had never connected those dots between their sinful ways and the struggles that they were facing. And they were really reliant upon Samuel to help them with that. And the opportunity for Saul to come in and just do tremendous things for the people was there. The children of Israel needed a spiritual leader. They needed someone to take up the mantle from Samuel and continue it onward and keep this momentum going. And so when this tremendous opportunity is presented to him via the Lord directly, Saul hides from it, literally. And several months back, Brother Alex discussed in one of his talks that this should have been a warning sign to the children of Israel, and I believe that that's absolutely true, because for whatever reason it was, whether Saul viewed this moment as too great or his standing, as he kind of professed, as a person of the tribe of Benjamin, his standing too small. He clearly didn't see the fact that even though this was a huge undertaking, that the Lord was on his side. And it's such a shame, because if he had realized that, you know, the opportunity was there for him to do just tremendous things, and no moment would have been too big, nor he ever too small, literally or figuratively. Yet, for as easy it is to laugh at Samuel here, and it's a bit of a humorous story in some ways, I wonder how many times I've been guilty of this very thing. I wonder of how many times in my Christian walk that I've shrunk from opportunities. How many times the Lord would have had to tell you where I was when opportunities deserve present themselves. And my mind is really drawn to when I first joined this body, how I had no intention on being a part of the mutual ministry. I shunned that as much as I could. I made excuses to others, excuses to myself, and I pushed that away like Saul pushed away what he had here. And it reminds me of what Jeff spoke on a few weeks back, of the man in Luke 9 and 59 who told Christ that he wanted to wait to bury his father in order to follow him. And that challenge that he faced, the challenge that Saul faced, is the challenge that faces us all. There will always be excuses for not embracing the opportunities we have to serve. There'll always be opportunities that appear better suited to other people. And we just have to remember that ultimately we need to embrace those opportunities, not just begrudgingly go through with them. We need to embrace them. We need to understand that the Lord will help us through. As I alluded to before, David really shows us the way here and really stands in such stark contrast to Saul. David relished his opportunities to be a spiritual leader for the nation of Israel. And we never really see him backing down from those challenges, even when they were great. And I know one that really comes to mind for me is his relationship with Saul early on, how after David was anointed by Samuel, that shortly thereafter, Saul calls for him to be a part of his court. And you can see how in David's mind this may have been a little questionable. We don't know if at that point Saul knew that David had been anointed. At some point he did become aware of it, as he told David he was aware he was going to be king. But whether he knew it at this moment or not, David could have looked at this and said, you know, is it really best for me to be working basically for the guy who I'm replacing? Isn't that likely going to cause some problems? And any apprehensions would have been proven true, as it wasn't that long after that that Saul sought to kill him. But we don't see any hesitation in David. Yet, to the contrary of what we would expect, it says that David loved him. And I just look at this as just such a tremendous example of facing an opportunity to serve, because I think that David did all of that because, as he said, he viewed Saul as the Lord's anointed, and he never backed down from that challenge. And I just look at that as such a strong reminder to us that in the face of opportunities to serve, even when they may appear difficult, that we need to embrace those and we need to trust in the Lord. Now, the next major event in Saul's life I'd like to discuss is in 1 Samuel chapter 13, which is another familiar passage to us. You can feel free to turn there. And there we see that Israel has come out, their army has come out to fight the Philistines after Saul attacked a garrison. And in response, the Philistines bring out a tremendous force, an overwhelming force. And the children of Israel are afraid. The army begins to scatter and the people hide. And so we pick up in verse 8 with Saul's army crumbling around him when it reads, "Then he," referring to Saul, "waited 7 days, according to the time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. So Saul said, 'Bring a burnt offering of peace offerings here to me.' And he offered the burnt offering. Now it happened, as soon as he had finished presenting the burnt offering, that Samuel came and Saul went out to meet him, that he might greet him. And Samuel said, 'What have you done?' Saul said, 'When I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, then I said, the Philistines now will come down on me at Gilgal, and I have not made supplication to the Lord. Therefore I felt compelled and offered a burnt offering.' And Samuel said to Saul, 'You have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever, but now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart. The Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you.'" Now, I think we can all empathize a little bit with Saul here. I think it only would have been natural to be afraid in this moment. But really what Saul was facing here was a choice between trusting in God or giving into fear, giving into temptation, and relying on his own wisdom. And although Saul obviously chose poorly, I question if I would have had the courage to do any differently. I like to believe that I would have trusted the Lord in that moment, but I'm mindful of all the times that I've given into sin and temptation in the face of significantly less adversity than this. How many times that I've given in to pressure from, whether it be from friends or from coworkers, given into sinful ways, and really what's that in comparison to what Saul was facing here? And in my mind, I just think it's a relatable thing, because it's so easy to be in a difficult circumstance, seemingly one that has no escape, or one where it's natural just to be afraid, to see no way of escape, and then just really fail to trust in the Lord and lean on our own will and our understanding, and to approach something that we know is wrong and to make excuses as why God's expectations are too great or why they don't apply to us in that moment, things that I'm ashamed to say I've done repeatedly in my walk. But yet again, we see David showing us what God expects. And in my mind, I think this is perhaps most typified by David in 1 Samuel chapter 24, because that's where we see him spare Saul's life. We talked about before about how David really embraced the ability to serve Saul, even though it seemed questionable. In chapter 24, Saul has been pursuing him, seeking to kill him, and David has him there. He can take his life. He can end this persecution that he's been facing. And if there was ever a moment to apply worldly wisdom, this was it. Because all David had to do was look at it and say, I have been anointed to replace Saul by the Lord. So if I have to kill Saul to make that happen, that only makes sense. That must be the Lord's will. Yet, we see him not do that. He spares Saul's life twice, telling him, let the Lord judge between you and me. Because David ultimately understood what we must remember, which is that we need to trust in the Lord, even when things are tough, even when the way of escape doesn't feel present, and in those moments, not to lean on our own understanding. Now, the third moment, then, in Saul's reign and life that I'd like to understand is the one contained within the reading this morning, and thank you again, Matt, for that. And here we really see the opposite situation from what we saw in chapter 13. Rather than facing an overwhelming force with a crumbling army, here the battle seems at hand. I know they seem to have the Amalekites right where they want him, and Saul knows that the Lord is on his side. He knows that this is what God would have him to do. But yet the Lord gives him one stipulation. He tells him that because of the fact that the Amalekites attacked the children of Israel in their flight from Egypt, as recorded in Exodus chapter 23, that they must be completely destroyed. Everything had to be wiped out, which the Lord previously alluded to in Deuteronomy 25. And then we see that the battle goes well, that the Amalekites are destroyed, yet Saul and the people spare King Agag the best of the sheep, the ox and the fatlings, the lambs, and as it says, all that was good. And because of this, Samuel tells Saul that the kingdom will be torn from him. Now, to me, this is even more frustrating than what we read about in chapter 13, because here, there is no crisis. Things are going well. Yet, for some reason, Saul just chose to ignore an explicit instruction from the Lord. Maybe he was thinking about Israel's weakened position, like we talked about before, that these things would have been valuable to them. Perhaps it was just greed, but seemingly, Saul just decided to trust in his own worldly wisdom rather than the Lord. Or perhaps what he says in verse 15 and again in verse 21 is true, that they truly did intend to spare those things in order to sacrifice them to the Lord. And this certainly seems like an excuse made up after the fact, and it doesn't really explain why King Agag was alive, but I find it interesting that Samuel doesn't address it as a lie. Rather, Samuel addresses it as if this was true. And he provides a rebuke in verses 22 and 23, and thank you, Nancy, for putting that on the bulletin, and it's a rebuke that I think sums up Saul's shortcomings so well when he says, has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as a sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you've rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. Rebellion is as a sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is iniquity and idolatry. Consider that for a moment, because Saul wasn't an idolatrous king. But here, Samuel is telling him that he may as well have been one because of his rebelliousness, his lack of obedience, and his stubbornness. And I find this rebuke, brethren, to be a terrifying one. I think we should be afraid when we read this because I think it's so easy for us to be guilty of this same thing. Because when we consider it, this sin of looking at what the Lord has told us to do and just going a step further, doing something that makes sense in our own minds, this goes on every day. Man looking at what God has told us to do and saying, I can do better. I know better. Whether it's with our assembly, our service to God, the church itself, it's so easy to try to take things one step further, whether it's in the name of efficiency, effectiveness, outreach, spreading the word of God, things that seem noble. But if you substitute those things for burnt offerings and sacrifices in verse 22, it becomes clear that the Lord wants, the Lord demands obedience above all else, even things that we think are done in his name. David knew that, and I believe it's one of the primary reasons he's referred to as a man after God's own heart. Because how many times do we see David going to the Lord and seeking to know what to do and then just simply doing it? I know I was struck by the number of times in 1 and 2 Samuel, how many times that happened. David going to the Lord, asking what he would have him to do, and then just simply doing that, no more, no less. And David wasn't perfect. I think he had a couple shortcomings in this area, like all of us. I think we can look at the moving of the ark or at his wanting to build the temple at times where he took things a step further than what the Lord expressed a desire for. But David ultimately learned his lesson on both those instances in terms of setting aside the building of the temple for Solomon, and then when the ark was moved the second time, doing it as the Lord would have him to do. And again, although David wasn't perfect, as no man here on earth other than Christ was, I think that he just provides us such an excellent example here of just trying to understand what the Lord desires for us, and then just simply doing that, no more, no less, regardless of seemingly our own worldly wisdom. Now, the last event in Saul's life I would like to discuss today is one that we pretty much exclusively associate with David, which is the account of David and Goliath. In chapter 17 of 1 Samuel, we see that, again, the Philistine army has come out against the Israel army led by Saul, and that, famously, Goliath comes forth, and that his tremendous size and his armor and weapons are described in detail. And then we read in verses 8 through 11, "Then he stood and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, 'Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourself, and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you will be our servants and serve us.' And the Philistine said, 'I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together.' When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid." And we all know what happens after that, that David defeats Goliath and that it was his moment, but this absolutely should have been Saul's moment. Saul should have been the champion for Israel. We read in 1 Samuel 10 and 23 and 24, "So they ran and brought him there," referring to Saul, "and when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. And Samuel said to all the people, 'Do you see him whom the Lord has chosen, that there is no one like him among the people?' So all the people shouted and said, 'Long live their king.'" This was their guy. They loved him for this fact. And this was the exact moment that they wanted a king for. Think back to chapter 8, verses 19 and 20 that I mentioned earlier, where they told Samuel, "No, but we will have a king over us, that we may also be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." So this was Saul's moment. This is what he was literally built for. This is why the people loved him, why they embraced him. This was why they wanted a king. We see when the moment comes, Saul doesn't stack up. He's not big enough. He's not strong enough. And ultimately, the children of Israel put their faith in the wrong thing. They put their faith in Saul's worldly abilities, his worldly attributes, rather than in the Lord. And those worldly things were not enough to overcome the things of this world. And it didn't have to be this way. If Saul had just leaned on the Lord rather than on himself, children of Israel did the same, he could have been the one to defeat Goliath. But what this demonstrates is that ultimately, we cannot defeat the things of this world with worldly things. We cannot overcome the world with worldly attributes. We cannot defeat science with science. We cannot defeat intellectualism with intellect. We will never be smart enough, eloquent enough, convincingly enough, because when we put our faith in those things, we can't overcome the world. The only thing that allows us to overcome this world is our faith in the Lord and his son sacrificed. And when we put our trust and our faith in those other things, we will always come up short. And I understand that those things, they have their utility. I know Brother Rick spoke last Sunday from the pulpit and gave an excellent sermon on how science supports what we read in Scripture when it pertains to the flood. And those things help us. Those things help us in our faith, in our conversation with others. But ultimately, I worry that sometimes it's very tempting for us to lean on those too much, to put our faith in those things to too great of a degree. Because none of those things can create faith in others, nor should they be the basis of our own. And this idea of leaning on God rather than our own worldly attributes or the worldly attributes of others is again typified by David, in this instance, right in this very moment. Because when David heard what Goliath had said, the blasphemy he had spoken against the Lord, he says in verse 26, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And it's after this, after expressing a desire to fight Goliath, that he's quickly mocked by his brother, that he's quickly discouraged by Saul, and ultimately, again, mocked by Goliath, all of them doubting his abilities. And for good reason. From a worldly perspective, there was no reason to think that David could defeat Goliath, but David didn't have a worldly perspective, nor did he trust in his own worldly abilities. And we read then in verses 45 through 47, "Then David said to the Philistine, 'You come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands.'" David knew he wasn't delivering Israel. He knew it wasn't his abilities, that it was the Lord. And that's where he placed his faith. And ultimately, that's perspective that we must have, that our faith will carry us through, not our worldly attributes, not our worldly abilities, nor those of anyone else. And just like David, we'll be mocked for this. We'll be made fun of for leaning on our faith, but ultimately, we just have to remember what we read here, brethren, that the Lord does not save with the sword, with the spear, with any ability that I or you may possess. The battle is his, and he is who we need to put our faith in, and in him alone. Those are my thoughts this morning. I appreciate your time and your attention. I hope this has been a useful exercise for you, and I hope that this provides you some things to think on and reflect upon. This time, then, as it's our tradition, we'll extend the gospel invitation. And if you're of the mind that you are now ready to lean on the Lord rather than your own abilities or your own understanding, we invite you to please come forward as we stand and sing the invitation hymn.